This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The old saying is that if life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. And regardless of how it turns out that life has been difficult, some people decide to persevere and they decide to go through it. And that means the same for education as well. Many people start high school. Many people don't finish high school. But many people also decide that they do want to get what is known as your HSE, which is the high school equivalency. And you do that by being involved in programs such as at the Center of Workforce Innovations, the Education Connection that is in place at the Adult Learning Centers. And we have with us on Regionally Speaking today one of the teachers at the Adult Learning Center and now one of the graduates of the program as well. Mallory is the student turned graduate, and the Adult Learning Center teacher is Danny Mancusi. And ladies, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio today.
Thank you.
Well, let me ask first, if you will, explain, Danny, what the Adult Learning Center programs are like for people that would decide they want to get their high school equivalency. It used to be known as GED. I think probably more people commonly know it as that, but it's officially known as high school equivalency.
Correct. So we serve quite a diverse population, Chris, and students, adults, come to us from all walks of life and all ages. The youngest we can serve as 16, and we've even had students in their 70s. And some of them drop out of high school for various reasons. You know, some have to fight addiction or homelessness. Some just come from, you know, not encouraging environments, and or they just drop out because they're bored and various reasons. But when they have the confidence to come to us, we help them prepare for the HSE. And we start with an assessment to see where their levels are. We're a non-traditional environment. Typically, students make appointments to study with us. When it's convenient for them, we try to meet them at their schedule. We've even had Saturday classes for students like Mallory because she has, you know, kids, and she has to take care of them during the week. So we had some really good Saturday sessions to help her prepare.
How difficult is it for someone to get involved in a program like this? Like I said, especially if you've gone through life, maybe you don't have the encouragement at home from family members to get your education. How difficult is it to make the decision that you're going to make something of yourself, make yourself better than maybe what your current situation might be?
That's a challenging for most people, and I'm going to let Mallory answer it because Mallory was really reluctant to join us, and I just encouraged, and some other people in our center encouraged her as well.
If it wasn't for Danny and the other people in the center, I don't know if I would have continued. They gave me the encouragement that I didn't have when I was younger and in school. So.
Mallory, well then, Mallory, if you will tell us then a little bit about yourself and that you like, as well as what you mentioned, it was a difficult decision to decide to go back to school because I guess not everybody is encouraged to either stay in school or to get involved. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what had prompted you to take the plunge and go back and do all the studying and all the adjusting that you have to do in your regular life to be able to get your education done.
I've had quite a life already. Mm-hmm. A lot of experiences, and in the situation that I'm currently in and still trying to get out of is homelessness. And right now I live in the shelter with my kids and my fiance, and and the way that I saw it, I wanted to go back, and it's something that I've always wanted to do was get my GED or my diploma.
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel like that was something that was holding me back from getting out of the homeless situation and just living so rough. I felt like that might help me pursue the stuff that I want to so that we never end up back in this position again. because I never want my kids to have to feel what I've felt growing up and been through the stuff that I've been through. So I'm trying to change that for them.
How difficult has it been to not completely start over, but because you did start and get some of your years of high school underway before you dropped out of the regular schooling system? How difficult was it for you to get back into the swing of things with education?
Oh, it was hard.
I imagine it might have been.
Yeah, as Danny will tell you, I was very reluctant on it. I didn't believe in myself at all. I didn't think I was going to do it. I didn't think it was possible to even pass. Especially for me, you know, I've always been told that, you know, I wasn't smart enough or I couldn't do it or, you know, I never had that. So it was a challenge, but when I saw the work being done and the progress being made, I knew I could do it. Mm-hmm. I saw the change.
How much help was Danny and other teachers at the Adult Learning Center for with you in getting you stay on the track and to keep going until you actually got your HSC here not long ago?
They were my full motivation. Mm-hmm. My cheerleaders, my personal cheerleaders. Yes, over there in the corner cheering, go Mallory.
Well, that's the way it has to be sometimes, and that's good
yes.
to know. It's good to know. Danny, let me ask you, if I may, when you encounter students in your classes, are you able to do it on a classroom type basis, or do you typically do it on a one-on-one, almost like a mentoring basis?
A little bit of both. Since mm-hmm. the pandemic, we've switched to more individual instruction and tutoring because we have to socially distance. But our space is large enough that sometimes we do have group lessons. Our Saturday class, we've had like two or three and they're distanced around a table and, you know, in front of me, and then there's a board behind me. But a lot of mentoring takes place among the career pathway facilitators, the instructional assistants, the teachers, to help students like Mallory break through or overcome the barriers.
Because a lot of it, I think, is fear.
She was really afraid of us, and she was honest about her fear, but I wouldn't let her leave until she tried.
That's good. That's good. What do you do? You have to do something to help keep some people on track. I would imagine that's the best way to do it as well. Well, Mallory, let me ask you, now that you have your high school equivalency certificate, where are you going from here? What are you able to do now with that HSC? What is the future like? What's the future look like for you?
Okay. Well, I do not plan on stopping, that's for sure, now that I know that things are possible. I plan on going to college. I haven't quite decided yet where I want to go and
right.
what I want to do, but I know I do want to go to college. I want to further my education. I feel like that's what we're put on this earth for, is to learn and move forward, you know, learn more and... Yes,
are there
others?
Let me ask: are there other many topics that you probably had a chance to learn about while you were getting your courses to get your HSC that interested you the most, or was there something maybe from even may have been a past difficult situation that made you decide to bolt on through, get your degree, so to speak, and to be able to go on for life? Any possible career paths that you're interested in?
Is my struggle, my life, like I said, it's been a road.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a little bumpy. I grew up in and out of foster care as a child, the system. I was in and out of it growing up. And I feel like that has kind of, going through all that has made me want to work with children kind of going through similar situations as me. So that's what I want to pursue, is something as like therapy, go to college to, you know, learn therapy for young adolescents, or to be Well, like what I'm doing, like right now, I'm working. I'm working alongside with Danny at the Adult Education Center, and I get to meet a bunch of different types of people going through different things, and that's something that really interests me because of everybody. You never know what somebody's going through. And like when people look at me, they think, "Oh, you're an addict. You were an addict.
Right.
You were homeless. You have kids." Nobody ever thinks those things when they look at me, and that's why I think it's important to. Well, that's why I want to work with young adults and teens because there's so much that people don't know that they hide and to help them, like for me, coming to get my GED and diploma I want other kids to know that there's a different path. There is other options because I've been down a lot of those paths.
Mm-hmm. Well, Danny,
and so far this is the only one that's doing me right.
That's good to hear. Now, Danny, let me ask you: now that we know that Mallory is on her way, you get to see her often because you're working together there at the Adult Learning Center in Valparaiso. What's ahead for future students? You get to mentor more people now as another group of students go through the HSE process.
Yes. We've actually started enrolling some students, and thanks to Mallory, she's become our official recruiter. So she's already been reaching out to people in situations like her on social media or groups that she's part of, and we already have a couple of people coming in this week.
That's great.
That know Mallory through some of the groups that she's been in, and you know it's great to meet these young people or all these people and watch them reach success. It's things what keeps us going. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Danny, let me ask in wrapping up our conversation here, if anyone is interested or knows of someone who is interested, needs help in that respect to get that high school equivalency diploma, and they want to get involved with the adult learning centers here in Northwest Indiana, how can they find out more?
Well, the Center for Workforce Innovations has adult learning centers through multiple counties in Northwest Indiana with amazing teachers that can help them succeed. And all they need to do is call CWI at 462-2940, and they will be connected with the learning center that's closest to them.
Well, Danny Mancusi is a teacher. She is with the Valparaiso Adult Learning Center and one of the students she had under her wing, so to speak, and who has now graduated, received her HSE, is Mallory. And ladies, thank you for being with us, telling about your stories and the education possibilities that can come about. Going back for that degree, that the giving up is not an option, that you have to continue on if you feel that you need to do so. It's one option that you can take advantage of. Thank you very much for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The city of Goshen is hoping that money from the federal government can help find the source of pollution in the city's drinking water wells. And reporter Rebecca Thiel tells us that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's proposed adding the North 5th Street groundwater contamination site to its national priorities list for cleanup.
Four public drinking water wells in Goshen are contaminated with 1,2-dichloroethane, an industrial chemical used to make things like PVC pipes and remove grease. It's also a byproduct of chemicals used in dry cleaning. High amounts of the chemical can damage your nervous system and cause liver and kidney diseases. Fortunately, the levels in Goshen's wells are far below the maximum allowed in drinking water and have been going down. But from 2014 to 2015, the city saw those levels jump to more than 3 times what they were before. Kent Holdren is the superintendent of Goshen's water department.
If it would get worse, you know, it could cause us to close a well field, and that'd be a huge expense to the citizens of Goshen.
The EPA has identified more than 60 possible sources of the pollution in 4 Goshen drinking water wells. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next conversation was first aired the day before the troop withdrawal in Afghanistan. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We are waiting now almost by the moment to find out more about what is happening in Afghanistan in particular as Americans are being evacuated from Kabul. But how about all of the efforts that have been trying to, in the recent weeks, certainly, and up to the decision to pull the troops out of Afghanistan, getting interpreters and their family members out? A number of veterans are helping out, and one of them in particular is a Northwest Indiana veteran. Chris McClanathan's with us to talk about his efforts and others of his colleagues trying to help those people who want to get out of Afghanistan to be able to do so. And Chris, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us first about the concerns that you have had and others I'm sure have had as well in people that you have had the opportunity to work with while you served over in Afghanistan.
Well, I mean, it's a very complicated situation right now, and you know, there's a lot of moving parts, and unfortunately, there's a great deal of chaos in terms of, you know, reports on the ground of what exactly is going on and who's getting on these flights, because all indications from the ground are that at some point they were just literally scooping up anyone they could find, and which is fine to have, you know, to scoop up the refugees, but it also means that there were not seats for people with legitimate documents to get on the plane, if that makes sense.
I know that a lot of the problems that have come about here are because of people that you have had the opportunity and others have had the opportunity to work with while serving overseas. The interpreters in particular, these are Afghans who pretty much have put their lives on the line, just as the soldiers have done, to be able to help out the soldiers in the effort to understand what's happening at the time that they're on duty over in Afghanistan. And now, as the Americans are leaving, and I know that in particular in the information that we have is that you've talked in one particular case to a fellow named Romal, who has helped you out when you were both working together in 2011. Will you tell us a little bit about him and the ways that you've had a chance to work with him, and in turn, how it's turned into now him looking for help to get he and his family out?
Well, you know, we worked together, probably half of the days that I was over there in Afghanistan. So I was there for almost a year, and he was helping us out do translation at the gate for people entering the base and out on convoys to talk with the local population. So at times I was working with him for 12 hours a day, every day. He was just like one of us, really.
When you work with somebody so closely, what's the experience like? Is it just as if you had somebody like another part of you, only this time it's somebody separately who understands the language and the characteristics of the people that you are around at the time, and certainly the traditions of life in Afghanistan?
Exactly. You know, they like the interpreters. They weren't just like, translate this document.
Right.
You know, they were giving us an insight into the culture and really helping us navigate, because, you know, their culture is very different from ours, and we want to be as respectful as we can. And they were really helpful in facilitating that and making sure that what we were trying to communicate was really getting across.
Now, you were deployed to northern Afghanistan back in 2011, and I guess you've stayed in touch over the years, but come 2021 now, how did it turn out that you have this all of a sudden contact with him and with his family?
Well, I mean, you know, we kind of, you know, sometimes you fall out of touch, and, you know, on and off, we were friends on Facebook, kind of liking each other's posts, and, you know, for a while as we did our thing, and then when the whole evacuation effort kicked off and the Taliban started taking cities, I reached out to him because he was on my mind at the time. So I reached out via Facebook and said, "Hey, are you okay?" And he said that he was safe for now, but he was scared for what was going to happen and that he needed my help. So that's kind of where it all started.
How long ago has it been since you finally got this very frantic set of conversations with him?
It's going on 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks now that I've been kind of working pretty much full time in this effort.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing that the contacts have certainly, it shows that how close a friendship, even if it's just a professional relationship, like in this case, a soldier and an interpreter, you know, you're figuring you're not talking about a much more personal than that. But it really is, because he's so much a part of you. He's helping keep you alive, and you're helping him stay alive too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, it's definitely not just a professional relationship. You know, he became as much of a brother to us as our fellow service members. You know, when you're over there in that kind of situation, you have to know that the person next to you has your back 100% no matter what, or the whole thing just falls apart. And so those interpreters who really put their lives on the line for us really, really just meshed in there, especially because they didn't have weapons. So they were completely dependent upon us for their protection. And that creates a really strong bond that doesn't go away after years of no contact. You know, you can just pick up like it was, exactly like it happened 5 minutes ago.
You've given us an idea of certainly the concerns in trying to help a fellow soldier in a way, although he's not with the U.S. Army. He's a fellow who's interpreting for the U.S. Army in that particular role. In trying to help get him and his family out, what's been the procedure, I guess, or the technique that you have used up to this point in trying to lobby the U.S. government to get him out of Kabul and to the United States?
I mean, basically what it's been is I've been reaching out to every contact I can, getting in contact with congressional offices, and there's been quite a few congressional staffers who have been working extremely hard to try and get these documents over to the State Department and to try and get them on a list for evacuation. But unfortunately, there's just so much bureaucracy that gets in the way of this kind of thing that it makes it really difficult to really reach someone.
I imagine this is going to be a situation that's going to continue on, even though we know we're just hours away from the end of at least the scheduled end for the evacuation of Americans from Afghanistan and from Kabul in particular. This is going to continue on past that point, I'm sure.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, we have a thing in the military, and we take it very seriously, is we don't leave people behind, no mm-hmm. matter what. And that includes our allies. So while some of our leadership may have forgotten that, the rest of us have not.
Chris McClanahan is a U.S. Army veteran. He served and was deployed to northern Afghanistan back in 2011. He worked very closely with a man named Romal, who's an outgoing and a very effective interpreter while he was serving his time over in Afghanistan. And now he's doing his best, along with other veterans, trying to do the same for other people from Afghanistan to get them out of Afghanistan and their family members and to the United States or someplace safer for them to live as the Taliban have taken over Afghanistan. Chris, thank you very much for spending time with us. We'll check back with you, and let's hope that at least the rest of the days ahead will work out well for everybody.
Thank you. I hope I have good news to share with you soon.
A new survey from Safewise reveals that as gun sales surged in Indiana, residents in the Hoosier State are a bit on edge about gun violence. More guns have been sold in Indiana than almost any other state in 2021. That's according to the FBI reports of more than 1.1 million firearm background checks performed in Indiana so far this year. And Safewise has put out a national survey, which is called the State of Safety in America 2021. And let's find out more how Indiana ranks in that survey. We have with us from Safewise safety expert Rebecca Edwards. And Rebecca, thanks for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you. I'm excited to dig into these numbers.
Well, this is a very, very interesting survey. First, tell us how it was put together. How many Americans were surveyed about their perceptions of crime and safety?
For the past 3 years, we've been conducting this survey to find out how people feel about safety and crime, and then we compare that to the reality of the stats to see if our fears line up. We speak to 5,000 Americans every single year, so it's been a total of 15,000 over the past three, and there's at least 100 in every single state represented each year.
How many Hoosiers are really, really concerned and have stated so in your work on the survey about the situation with gun violence almost every day?
Yeah, 60% of the Indiana residents that we talked to said they are highly worried. It's a top-of-mind consideration every single day when it comes to gun violence. And the national average is 53%. So they're quite a bit more concerned than the rest of the country.
Will you go down some of the other key statistics that the survey has brought out and let people know at least how in Indiana things shaped up as discovering the issues and talking about the issues of gun violence?
Yes. So overall, less than half of Indiana residents, 48%, think the state is a safe place to live. And 10% of Indiana residents told us that they or someone they know were a victim of gun violence in the last 12 months, which is higher than the national average, but it's a 70% drop year over year, which is interesting. And we also found that mass shootings in the state decreased year over year from 2019 to 2020, but so far this year, you're already over the total that happened in the state, according to the Gun Violence Archive in 2020. Mm-hmm. So we're not on a good track this year.
Seems to sound that way, to be sure. how many Indiana residents have reported that when you did the questions for the survey is to say that they have firearms in their homes or their other property to protect themselves because of the concerns they have about gun violence out there?
You know, when it comes to protecting property, almost one in four Indiana residents say that they use a firearm to protect their property, which is pretty on par with the national average. But when it comes to personal protection, only 17% of Indiana residents say they use a concealed carry firearm. Mm-hmm. Now, this survey was conducted in the last quarter of 2020. So, and reports show that Indiana came in sixth for the most concealed carry permits issued last year. That number might be different when we ask that question this year, but nationally, 38% say they're using concealed firearms. So it's interesting that it's top of mind for Indiana, but about half as many as the rest of the country are using concealed firearms.
Mm-hmm. Well, from the information that you have together, you mentioned specifically about Indiana, but how does the survey results from Indiana rank with, say, other Midwestern states, Illinois or Michigan or Ohio, for that matter?
Well, Indiana, as I said, you know, overall, you're a lot higher than most states across the board when it comes to gun violence. I'm going to take a real quick peek. Mm-hmm. You know, Illinois is the fifth most concerned. So Illinois is more worried. And it does make a lot of sense because Chicago is in Illinois. And I know you guys are neighbors, but I think the huge surge that we've seen in major metro areas like Chicago and New York are really amping those states up as far as concern goes. But other cities or other states in the area, Ohio, you know, Michigan, they're falling on the lower end of the scale. They're just not as concerned. I'd say Illinois and Indiana are the two highest concerned states about gun violence in that area.
Since you folks with SafeWise are very concerned about safety overall, not only about gun safety or the issues that come about from gun safety possibly or other problems that can come about, but how much of the information that we happen to get every day that's in the news seems to affect people in particular here in Indiana about the issues and the problems of gun violence? We're not even, you know, perhaps not even in a community. We're even talking about in some other part of the state or some other state.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, there's a huge disconnect between how much we're worrying about crime and safety and issues like gun violence and how much they're actually happening, which is good news because, you know, 68% of people in Indiana and across the country just about think crime has been on the rise and has been consistently, where for the last three decades, crime overall has consistently trended down. So I think that the accessibility of news and headlines and information, whether we don't have to turn on news at 11 to find out what's happening in the world anymore. My mom can send me a Facebook message or I can see a string of tweets and I'm getting information a lot more ways than I used to. And having that influx in front of us all the time, it increases how much we're worrying. And I think that's across the board and it definitely makes a difference in Indiana.
Now, do you and your colleagues at SafeWise have an opportunity, if you don't speak with others and putting the report together, you probably have a chance to confer about this. And what do you advise people who turn to you for more information about safety issues? What do you tell them about trying to deal with the issue of gun safety in particular, but gun violence as it comes about?
Yeah, when it comes to all kinds of safety, and gun violence is no exception, you know, our biggest advice is to be proactive about what you're doing. If you're worried, if there's something that you're afraid of and you're concerned about it, learn more about it. Learn how to handle it properly. I mean, I think if you're just spending a lot of time with a lot of anxiety and doom scrolling, don't feed your brain the things that make you nervous all the time. And we had a lot of comments, open comments from people this year mentioning, I'm afraid that, like, I got a gun, but I'm afraid if I had to use it, I wouldn't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to, whether it's a security system, whether it's a security camera, whether it's a firearm, if you're going to use that as a form of protection, take the classes, learn how to use it, get comfortable with it. Know that if you needed to defend yourself and your family, you're doing it the safest and the most proper way possible. And that's where a lot of people are afraid because of accidental shootings, obviously, are a big concern. And these are things you can be proactive about and prevent. There's a lot that you can do to not have a gun-related incident end in the worst possible way.
Rebecca Edwards is a safety expert for SafeWise, and SafeWise has just put out the results of a new survey recently conducted, checking in with more than 5,000 Americans nationwide about perceptions of crime and safety. And the latest report for Indiana shows that 60% of Hoosiers surveyed are highly concerned about gun violence every single day. Rebecca, thank you for joining us and telling us the information, and we're looking forward to another survey coming out later. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.